The subject we have been assigned this evening has to do with submitting to governing authorities. Let me read you the assignment and then we'll talk about it. To what extent are we to submit to the civil authorities? Is civil disobedience and or taking up arms appropriate for believers when there's no seeming contradiction between man's law and God's law? As an example, in the American Revolution, how should a believer have reacted, loyalist or sons of liberty? In the current political climate, do we undermine the legitimacy of our government officials and undermine our witness of Christ by diving in and contributing to the conversational fire and fury? How do we responsibly handle political labeling, conservative right wing, liberal left wing, and party affiliations? You know, I don't know who wrote this. Who is it? Tom Woody used to write them. They were so much better. But I thought it might have been Eric because of the last line. We know you'll express an opinion and truth which will satisfy all concerned. Thanks, Eric. 1st thing we need to nail down is that history has a good word to say for government in general. Given the nature of man, government is better than no government. And as irritated with our government as we may sometimes be, it's better than no government. Not only is that true, but it could get a whole lot worse and still be better than no government. I'm not going to take the time at the moment to read the 18th chapter of Judges, but were we to do that, we would see a good illustration of how anarchy devolves, how life becomes almost unbearable under those conditions. We love freedom, and the first condition of freedom is its limitation. Freedom is always qualified by forces both inside and outside of man. When we try to make freedom absolute, it dies in chaos. The prime task of government is to establish order. Organized central force of government is the sole alternative to incalculably destructive force in private hands. As you and I sit here this evening, we have a reasonable expectation that when we go home later this evening or later this week, we will find things as we left them. If we had no government, that expectation would not be nearly so reasonable. If everybody was left to follow the full bent of his own will without fear, then we'd have the situation that we read about in the time before the flood. Genesis chapter 6, verse 11, the earth was filled with violence. Just think about what that means. What that really means. The whole earth was filled with violence. It's awful to contemplate what that truly means. So, when Noah came out of the ark, God said, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God created he man." Genesis 9, verse 6. By man shall his blood be shed. Not man in the sense of vigilantism, but man in the sense of a duly constituted government. Civil government was ordained by God, not by Satan, as some have said. The Bible is clear that it's ordained by God. Power naturally converges toward a center because power is ineffective when it's divided. That is the process that has centered power in the federal government of the United States at this time. When the economy was ignoring the boundary lines of states and could be regulated only by some central authority, then all the talk about states' rights had to be tamped down and limited. Now, in Paul's day, the Pharisees and the Zealots said it was wrong to acknowledge any kind of a Gentile ruler. Acts 18 and 2 says that at a certain point, Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome. undoubtedly partly because of their attitude toward the Roman government. The gospel went to the Jew first. There were thousands of Jews in the church before there was a single Gentile in it. In the early days, the church was filled with Jews. And to a degree, the Jewish attitude toward Gentile government came into the early church. Acts 17, verse 7 says that there was an accusation brought against the Christians, and it was this: "These all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus." It was easy for some of the early Christians to have a problem reconciling the kingship of Jesus with the Gentile rule on earth. And we can easily understand what their thinking must have been. Jesus is the real king. We live by his law. He's going to get us out of here soon. Therefore, we don't need to pay any attention to these governments of men. They're destined for destruction any day, anyway. And that's why we have the first seven verses of Romans chapter 13. Jerry read it publicly for us on Monday, but you weren't all here on Monday, and we probably just, in general, need to have it set before our minds again, because this gives the fullest development of our assigned topic in the entire Bible. Romans 13, 1 through 7. Paul says, writing to people in the very capital of the Roman Empire, Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore you must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Paul shows that the state is ordained by God and it has its own definite duties, and Paul studiously avoids two kinds of errors. The first category of error that Paul avoids is the view that would unite together church and state. This is very important because at the very moment that a church is united with a state, then right there, if not before right there, it ceases to be the Lord's church. We have inklings of this, I believe, in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, where the woman representing the church gives birth to a man-child that seems to me to give to have something to do with the state church. It's different from the remnant of her seed. It's in a different category. However that may be, this is the error that Paul is avoiding. Paul carefully maintains a he, ye separation here. He the state and ye the church. But Paul also avoids a second contradictory point of view, a second opposite extreme that would set church and state in automatic opposition to each other. He shows that there's nothing in the essence of either church or state that makes them necessarily opposed to each other. So the bottom line here is that Paul does not oppose church and state to one another, nor does he confuse church and state with one another. And he says in verse 3, rulers are not a terror to good works. This is a statement of general truth. In the Bible, there are many such statements of general truth. An example from the Old Testament, Proverbs chapter 16, verse 7. When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. That's a statement of the ideal, and it's true as a general rule. If you live according to the Bible, you're going to have a pacifying influence in general on your family, your neighbors, and your community. But it's not absolutely true in every case, is it? And exhibit A is Jesus Christ. His ways pleased the Lord perfectly, and yet they nailed him. So he didn't make even his enemies to be at peace with him. Is that a violation of Proverbs 16:7? No, it's the perhaps exception that proves the rule. It's a general statement of truth. And I believe that in Romans 12:3, when we read that rulers are not a terror to good works, we have a similar general statement of the ideal. Paul is speaking of rulers in general. According to the true intent of their office, they are not a fright to good works. It's generally true that those who do good works have nothing to fear from the laws. The design of the ordination of government by God was not to injure, not to oppress the good, but to detect and punish the evil. Officials of government, as God appointed them, are not a terror to good works. The fact that rulers sometimes fail in this is not discussed here any more than the murder of Jesus by his enemies is discussed in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 7. It's the theory of all the laws of all civilized government to uphold justice. Paul wrote the Roman letter during the reign of Nero, and that is a very telling thing. Nero, of all people, Nero was the acme of cruelty. It is fair to point out that the Roman letter was written before the Neronian persecutions began. Romans was written approximately 57 AD, and the great fire prompting the persecutions wasn't until 64 AD. But on the other hand, it's also true to say that when God inspired the Roman letter, he knew what would happen in 7 years. And he says, even though it's Nero, you need to be subject. Even those persecutions that came on Christians under Nero and others later were needed by the Christians to promote their eternal welfare. God permits only as much affliction on his people as will promote their true good. Rulers are not appointed to terrify those of their citizens who do good works. Power is entrusted to them for the benefit of the community. Now, obviously, corruption exists in government. I don't know of a government where corruption does not exist to some extent. Lord Acton was the man who famously said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. One time I was riding along with Roger Winawson in the Philippines, and I asked him, what's the biggest problem here in your country? Without hesitation, he said, governmental corruption. And that's true. The government robs the people blind. Everybody remembers the Marcoses, Ferdinand and Isabel Marcos, and there's been more since that time. You put $1,000 in cash in an envelope, mail it to somebody in the United States, and most likely it will arrive to them. Put $1,000 in cash in an envelope, mail it to somebody in England, most likely it will arrive to them. I've done that myself. But you put $1,000 in cash in an envelope and try to mail it to somebody in the Philippines, and it most likely will not get there because government corruption is at work. And this is true in many or probably most countries around the world. It's a big problem when the biggest criminals are the police. That was a huge problem in the Soviet Union, for example. Governmental corruption has been a problem in every place and time because of the nature of man. Think of all the Old Testament injunctions against judges accepting bribes. Montaigne told a story about a judge in Persia. This judge was bribed. He rendered a wrong verdict for money. Cambyses was the Persian king, and he heard what happened. He ordered that judge to be executed. And after he was executed, he ordered his soldiers to skin that judge. They skinned the body of that judge like you'd skin an animal for its pelt. Cambyses then took that skin, and with it he covered a chair. And from then on, every judge in that particular Persian court had to sit in that chair. That would be a good reminder to render correct verdicts. Many other countries around the world make our government look lily white by comparison, but we're all aware of the huge problems within our own government. And this can be distressing to us, and when we are distressed about it, there are a couple of things we need to keep in mind. The first thing we need to keep in mind is that the form of government or the political situation under which we find ourselves at our particular point in time is not the primary concern of our lives, not if we're Christians. Our kingdom is not of this world. Jesus was explicit in this. My kingdom is not of this world. And if you're in his kingdom, then your kingdom is not of this world. Our citizenship is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile bodies, that they may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. Philippians 3:20 and 21. Our citizenship is in heaven. Our secondary citizenship is on this earth, and it has its place, and its place is second. It's a distant second, and we must not ascribe to it more weight than it carries. We are not to be politically dependent. We can live a godly life, and we can be saved under any political system man can devise. Let me illustrate this with a couple Old Testament characters. David. David had the most perfect political system available on the earth in his day. It wasn't the most perfect political system that could possibly be. The theocracy had been that, and the people had already gotten rid of the theocracy with their longing for a king, and God had allowed a king. But David was in the kingdom of God on earth, and he was the king. He was the policymaker. He was in control on a human level. The kingship is not the ideal, but it was reasonably good when you were the king and you had control. All David had to do was follow God's laws, and he had free reign to do so. But he still messed up. He still ended up using his powerful office to facilitate adultery, murder, and cover-up. Having the best political system on earth at the time was no guarantee for David. The nature of man comes into play. Daniel, by contrast, was a slave, taken away from home at a young age. He was subjected to the political vagaries and vicissitudes of one idolatrous foreign power after another in succession. And though he had every social and every political excuse to fail, we're never told that Daniel messed up. We can serve well, and we can please God, no matter what government we live under, and we are expected to. The second point, though, is very important as well. Even though it is a secondary citizenship, we do love our wonderful country. I put my hand over my heart and pledge allegiance to our flag. I get goosebumps when we sing the national anthem. I believe that the United States of America was providentially established by God on this continent at a specific time and for a specific reason. I believe that we who are citizens of it are among the most blessed people ever to have lived. And I believe that unto whom much is given, of him shall also much be required. Luke 12, verse 48. I'm not proud to be an American, but I am very, very grateful to be an American. I believe that you and I have the right to legally and peacefully protest our laws or our system to bring about change for good. You have every right to do that as a Christian, and you have every right to do that as an American. These rights are built into our basic laws. Remember, the Bill of Rights wasn't even part of the Constitution as it was originally written, but they had to tack it on there in order to get the states to ratify the thing. The First Amendment is an amendment. The Second Amendment is an amendment, and so on down the list. And it made an important difference, an important change for everybody who has lived since that time in America. Martin Luther King put it best. Somewhere I read about the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read about the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for rights. But we do need to distinguish between the church and the individual Christian. It is your obligation as the church to teach the Bible, and the Bible light will expose the corruption of man. It is your obligation as the church to pray for our country. It is your right as a Christian and as an American to legally and peacefully protest to bring about change. You have at least the same right to be politically involved as you do to go fishing or to play golf. And you yourself, as a free American, have to decide how much of your life to allot to political involvement or fishing or golf. If you as an individual want to campaign for a certain candidate, you certainly have every right to do that. But I caution you, do not polarize one another in the church over political issues. And I say this strongly as somebody who has been more than a little guilty of this. I could give you examples, but even the examples are polarizing, so just forget the examples. I have had people in the church say to me on more than one occasion, I don't know how you can call yourself a Christian and vote for, and then they filled in the name. Well, if you consider a statement like that to be fighting words, then you need to be very careful. Don't set at naught a brother or sister for whom Christ died over these sorts of differences. These are my dear brothers and sisters in Christ. They have different opinions than I do for whatever reasons. And in their mind, their reasons are just as valid. The fact that I may believe strongly that they are wrong is not the point. Of course I believe I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I'd change until I thought I was right. That's axiomatic. But I do believe in having strong, well-thought-out convictions. I believe in being fully persuaded in your own mind. But I also strongly believe in keeping the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And I have been guilty of flippantly making public statements that I just should not have made. I should have known better at the time. I hope I know better now. And I could give you a dozen illustrations of that. I don't know why it takes me so long to learn. Just plain dumbness on my part. I've learned to keep my mouth where it ought to be more. If I happen to be living in somebody's home during an election time, and I've done this on several occasions, if we're watching the returns come in late in the evening, and it's not going the way the people I am sitting with wanted it to go, and maybe it is going the way I wanted it to go, I go into the bathroom to do my fist pump. Not in front of them. You know, you're not going to rub it in. Because the church is above and beyond politics. It's bigger than politics. My kingdom is not of this world. The church, as such, does not endorse political candidates. The church is just not in that business. Now, if you, as an individual, decide to run for office, I believe you have that right. But don't campaign in the assembly, and don't expect all your brethren to vote for you. Let me ask you this. When did the Apostle Paul ever try to change the politics of Rome? Isn't it true that in the New Testament, the main concern was never for any particular country? The church is bigger than that. It's all around this world. Jesus did not directly try to change things politically. And the reason for that is quite profound. He knew that a changed world would be brought about by changed people. So he wasn't interested in legislation nearly as much as he was interested in hearts. He got beneath the surface of things. He worked on the hearts of people. And you and I will not change things primarily by legislation. We will only change things by persuasion and repentance and conversion. We preach the gospel and change the world one life at a time. Yes, it's slow. Yes, it's frustrating. And that's why we may sometimes want to get involved more in some of these other avenues. But if people believe the Bible, they will tend to live and vote according to the teaching of the Bible. What's the teaching of the Bible? Well, we talked about Romans 13. What does the Apostle Peter say in 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17? Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, or unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. You know, it's very easy for me as a taxpayer to think in terms of what I deserve. When I think that way, I need to remember the quite, I think, bemused attitude of the Lord on the subject of taxes. I don't know what word to use, but bemused. Maybe you'll have a better word. Just remember with me Matthew 17, verses 24 through 27. When they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, Doth not your master pay tribute? And he said, Yes. And when he was coming to the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, "What thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers?" Peter saith unto him, "Of strangers." Jesus saith unto him, "Then are the children free." In other words, Peter, we could make a reasonable argument that we really don't even have to pay these taxes if everything were just and justified, if everything were really as it ought to be. We ought not to be having to pay this. Nevertheless, notwithstanding, he says, that's not a fight that's worth our time. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them. See why I say bemused? Here we have the creator of the universe, and he's dealing with these puny little governments of man that think they're so great and powerful. No wonder he's bemused. "Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go thou to the sea, cast in a hook, take up the first fish that comes up, and when you've opened his mouth, you'll find a piece of money." Jesus could get money anywhere. It didn't matter. "Take that and give unto them for me and for thee." Jesus paid taxes. Do you think Jesus liked everything the government did with the tax money he paid? You know he didn't. A little later in Matthew 22, 17 through 21, Jesus was asked, "Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?" And Jesus answers, "Render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's." So he not only paid taxes himself, he said that we should pay taxes to Caesar. Was Jesus endorsing everything Caesar did with the tax money? Like you, I get very irritated at the way our tax money is spent. But as a Christian, I just need to step back and calm down. I am to submit to the government as unto the Lord who ordained it. And I don't want to use even a righteous cause, which we very well may have sometimes, as a cloak of maliciousness in approaching the government over something that we think is wrong. Well, I think we have to be very, very careful about this type of thing. Now, this is a special time of year in our country when we remember our freedom. This is a time when we celebrate what it means to enjoy liberty. Lincoln said that our nation was conceived in liberty, and that's absolutely right. And if there is a traditional hallmark of our nation, it would be our love of freedom. American has become a term that is somewhat synonymous with being free. This is one of our highest held and one of our most praised and prized blessings. We thank God for the freedom that we have. The next part of this assignment, which I already read to you, says, "In the American Revolution, how should a believer have reacted, loyalist or sons of liberty?" All of you know that the American Revolutionary War was one of the pivotal events in the history of the whole world. And the constitutional republic that has followed from it has produced the freest and most productive society ever. Most of the founding fathers were religious men. And the liberty that they fought for has benefited millions of people. During the years leading up to the Revolutionary War, the issue of a justified rebellion was widely debated, and there were good men on both sides of the issue. But really, to the Bible believer, really to the one who's trying to be scriptural about this, it all comes down to Romans 13. As we saw, that passage starts with a clear-cut command to submit to the governing authorities. And he says that the reason is that the governing authorities are ordained by God. And he says, therefore, resisting earthly authority is the same as resisting God. He says that rulers are a deterrent to evil in society. He says that a ruler is God's servant, bringing retribution to the wrongdoer. So he says Christians should submit to human authority, not only to avoid punishment, but also to maintain a clear conscience before God. And he says that Christians should pay their taxes, and that Christians should pay the proper respect and honor to the servants of God, meaning the governing authorities. The commands here in Romans 13 are quite broad, and they're aimed at everybody, and there are no exceptions listed. And remember, I stress again, when Paul wrote Romans 13, Nero was on the throne. Am I supposed to believe that George III was worse than Nero? And if I can't get myself to believe that, then where does that leave me scripturally? If Romans 13 applies to the cruel and capricious Nero, then it applies to all kings. The early church followed the principles of Romans 13, even during the wicked and oppressive reigns of Claudius and Caligula. No qualifications are given in Romans 13. No outs are given in that passage. Paul does not say, be subject to the king unless he is oppressive. He does not say, you must obey all rulers except for tyrants. The plain teaching of Romans 13 is that all governments in all places are to be honored and obeyed. Now, that's not to say that God approves of everything that governments do. It's not to say that kings are always right. Scripture has many examples of kings being held to account by God. Scripture does not teach that Christians must always obey the governing authorities, no matter what. But there's just one exception. And that's when man's laws are in direct conflict with the plainly revealed commands of God. Peter and John practiced civil disobedience, and it was perfectly appropriate for them to do so in their place and God. They were told to shut up. They could not but speak the things which they have seen and heard. That was their job to do that. Back in the Old Testament, the Hebrew midwives refused to kill babies, and they should have refused. Daniel ignored the Persian law concerning prayer, and he should have ignored it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow to the image of the king. Our kingdom is not of this world. We always pick the Lord's kingdom and his laws over the laws of man. Our citizenship is in heaven. Therefore, our focus is a heavenly focus, and all earthly foci are subservient to that. So, as a general rule, we are to obey the government. The lone exception being when obeying man's law would force us to directly disobey God's law. Now to the question specifically. Over the last half century, I have heard and read many more attempts than I can count to justify the American Revolution on scriptural grounds. And I concede that there are many nuances to the arguments. There were different kinds of colonies among the original 13. There were royal colonies, there were proprietary colonies, there were charter colonies. It's true. And each of those kinds of colonies was different legally and put different obligations on the citizens. That's all true. But it's also true that they were all English colonies. There is the idea that the American Revolution was not really a rebellion. Well, the British sure thought it was a rebellion. Some of these colonists saw themselves not as anti-government, but as anti-tyranny, and they said that no king who behaved as wickedly as George III could still be considered God's servant in the context of Romans 13. They saw the war as a defensive action, not as an offensive war. And it's true that in 1775 and 1776, they had presented the king with formal appeals for reconciliation, such as the Olive Branch Resolution and others. And the king refused to accept those. And their peaceful pleas sometimes did meet with armed military force and violations of British common law and violations of the English Bill of Rights. That's all true. I believe that many of the American patriots who fought against England were convinced that they had biblical precedent and that they had scriptural justification for their rebellion. But I remain convinced that their view of Romans 13 and their view of 1 Peter 2 is a faulty interpretation. And I also believe that once you start down the road of taking that kind of an interpretation of those passages, you will always be able to convince yourself that the government is wrong enough that you're justified in rebelling against it, for things large and small. You'll always be able to convince yourself that you're justified to rebel once you start down that road. So, as I said at the two-week meeting at 601 South Liberty in Independence, Missouri in 1970, 48 years ago, I would have had to have been a Tory. If you have a different view than that, scripturally speaking, I would love to hear it. Not right now, because I don't think this is supposed to be a discussion. I kind of wish it was, but not supposed to be a discussion tonight, I think. But feel free to come to me if you've got a scriptural justification for your personal involvement in the American Revolution if you had been back there. However, even though I believe that way about it, just as soon as George III issued the statement that he issued, His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States to be free, sovereign, and independent states, and relinquishes all claims to the government of the same and every part thereof, then immediately at that point, as a Christian, I've got a new government, and I owe that new government my subjection, my tribute, and my prayers. I believe that God providentially set up the Roman Empire with its Pax Romana to facilitate the spread of the gospel in the first century, and I believe just as providentially that He set up the American experiment similarly for the advancement of the church on our continent and from here to the rest of the world. But my personal involvement in it would have had to have been a different thing. I say again, unto whom much is given, of him shall much be required. Never forget the first page of The Great Gatsby that some of you had to read in school, and you at least read the first page, surely. The narrator says that his father told him, quote, "Just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had." It's really true, and it's true of you. It's true of me. And therefore, we have obligations that a lot of other people don't have. All right, back to the assignment again. In the current political climate, do we undermine the legitimacy of our government officials and undermine our witness for Christ by diving in and contributing to the conversational fire and fury? This is a very timely question, as I think you know. It seems that the American populace at present is more bitterly divided than at any time since the Civil War. We had a rough time back in the 60s, but I think what we have now is worse, if only because we have so much more media, and we have so much more hype, and so much more communicative technology now. So how do you respond to this as a child of God? The first thing is to love the truth and acknowledge the possibility that in any given argument, all of the truth may not be on any one side. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt. Acknowledge truth whenever anybody on any side speaks it. Even acknowledge truth when the devil speaks it, as he sometimes has. Receive the love of the truth, as Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Receive the love of the truth rather than just trying to prove a point. Realize that many things are nuanced rather than absolute. This is an important thing to think about. I believe that conversations regarding these matters can sometimes be quite helpful for the people involved. They can be neutral or they can be a disaster, and I've seen all of those. And I believe it mainly depends on the people involved. There are a lot of unreasonable people around. There are even stupid people around. God wants us to take care of these people and relate to these people. We're all ignorant just about different things. Some of us are very highly emotionally driven. So, in or out of the church, we need to be polite, we need to be kind, we need to be aware of the nature of the people that we're talking to in any given conversation. At the end of the book of Jude, we are given a principle, and I think it's a very important one. Some save with compassion, making a difference. Others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. Jude is talking about religious conversations there. But the idea is that we talk with different people in different ways, depending on the people and the situation. And that's true for worldly discussions as well. You don't say the same things to everybody. You just don't go out and hit everybody over the head with blunt force truth. The Lord didn't do that. When he did it on good judgment. But he did not usually function in that way. You just don't say the same things to everybody. Jesus didn't, and he said he didn't. The apostles didn't, and they said they didn't. They considered the situation. They considered the nature of the people they were talking to. And they made judgments about what to say and when to keep still. We should do the same, whether we're talking about overhauling an engine or who we're planning to vote for. Every time we have elections coming up, these issues come up in the church. I think now that it's more contentious than normal. And this is why we need to be so careful of each other and speak the truth in love. speak truth, but speak it in love. Truth is to be meted out with discernment. Now, we also have this about the labeling. Left versus right, liberal versus conservative. What do we do about that? You know, both of my grandfathers were born in the 19th century, and the conventional wisdom in their generation said, never discuss politics or religion. I don't know how many times I heard that as a boy growing up. I was around a lot of people born in the 19th century. And I've never understood how you can be a Christian without discussing religion. I discuss it all the time, and I hope you do too. That's what drives us. That's what guides us. And we should talk about it again, speaking the truth in love. We don't have to talk about politics, but yet if you care about something, like we care about our wonderful country, then out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. Personally, I've never been averse to discussing politics, but I do believe we need to be very careful discussing politics publicly in the church, not at all, or virtually not at all. That's not the purpose of the church. That's not the purpose of the public teaching in the church. And we have to be careful with these words I've been asked about, because these words shift meanings, and your use of these words might not communicate what you think you're communicating to somebody who hears them. They're changing all the time. The words liberal and conservative are really quite nebulous, I think. 100 years ago, the word liberal meant the opposite of what it means right now. Its meaning was similar to what the word libertarian means now. In other words, it carries the idea of liberty. The idea behind libertarianism is, live as you please and don't expect me to pay for it. But that's what the word liberal used to mean. Now, the term liberalism has come to be associated with a very different emphasis and seemingly with a readiness to rely primarily on the state. The catchwords have become welfare and equality rather than freedom. I think it's important for each one of us to think through these issues and our own beliefs about what government should be and what the ideal is. I believe in a free person's belief in his own responsibility for his own destiny. I think the Bible teaches that from the early chapters of Genesis on through. To a free person, the country is a collection of the individuals who compose it, not something that is over and above them. The government then is a means. The government is an instrumentality, not a grantor of favors and gifts, and not a master. The free person does not ask what his country can do for him, and he does not ask what he can do for his country. Rather, he asks, what can I and my fellow citizens do through government to fulfill our responsibilities, to achieve our goals, and to protect our freedom? The big question here is, how can we keep the government we create from becoming a Frankenstein that will destroy the very freedom we establish it to protect? Because freedom is such a rare and delicate plant. Remember Rousseau in The Social Contract? That was another book we got assigned in school. And the very first sentence, surely you read the first sentence if you didn't read any more of it. Very first sentence, number one, of The Social Contract is brilliant. Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains. And it was true. If you go over here in the woods and you catch a little rabbit or a bird or a frog, it struggles in your hands to be free. All God's creatures want to be free. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again in the yoke of bondage. Paul was talking spiritually, yes, but freedom is good in every aspect of life. I love freedom. I think we all do. Government is necessary to preserve our freedom. But by concentrating power in political hands, it also becomes a threat to freedom. The power to do good is also the power to do harm. Those who control power today may not control it tomorrow. And that power attracts those who want to control other people, who want to control you. What one person thinks is good, another person thinks is harmful. So the scope of government should be limited. Thomas Jefferson was the man who said, that government governs best which governs least. Its major function is to protect our freedom from enemies both inside and outside, and to preserve order, to enforce private contracts, and to foster competitive markets. Government is to accomplish this jointly. what we would find it impossible to accomplish individually. But governmental power must be dispersed to be good. If government is to exercise power, it's better in the county than in the state, it's better in the state than in Washington. If I don't like what my local community does, I can move to another community. If I don't like what my state does, I can move to another state. But if I don't like what Washington imposes, I don't have many alternatives left in this old world of jealous nations. And the great advances of civilization have never been through centralized government. Columbus didn't come looking for a new route to China in response to a directive from a parliament somewhere. Newton and Leibniz, Einstein and Bohr, Edison, Ford, Florence Nightingale, Albert Schweitzer, no matter what their area of endeavor was, none of these people opened up those new frontiers in response to governmental directives. Look at the Wright brothers. Do you realize the American government was pouring money hand over fist into trying to get somebody to invent a flying machine? But it took two guys in a little bicycle shop in Ohio that didn't even have electricity to do the job independently and without help. No government help. These achievements were the product of individual genius, of strongly held minority views, and a social climate of freedom. Why didn't George Washington have a cell phone? When George Washington was out surveying, he was walking over the ground that had everything in it that goes to make a cell phone. Why didn't he have one? You know, government can never duplicate individual action. Government invariably and by its very nature substitutes uniform mediocrity for the variety that's essential for the experimentation that leads to the inventions and the advances that we want. Because of the modern corruption of the term liberalism, the views that formerly went under that name are now often labeled as conservatism. So I guess I'd say I'm conservative because I want to conserve freedom. But I have a lot of concern about people as well. So there are nuances to this. I do believe that if we have a theory of government, we have to think about economic freedom. It's an important part of total freedom. When I was a kid, we always had a big garden. I could raise a lot of tomatoes in the backyard. When they were ripe, I took them to the road. We lived on a busy street. I sold tomatoes and vegetables to people who saw my sign and stopped. I set the price. If people didn't like it, they could either try to negotiate or they could go to somebody else's vegetable stand. There was no government telling me what I could charge. There was no government telling them what they had to buy. Both parties in the economic transaction benefited from it. It was pure laissez-faire capitalism. I believed in it then. I believe in it now. And because we still live in a largely free society, it's easy to forget how limited the span of time is and how limited the part of the globe is for which there has ever been anything like political freedom. The typical state of mankind is tyranny and servitude and misery. That's the way it's always been. In our little exception in the Western world, political freedom came with a free market. So did political freedom in the Golden Age of Greece and in the early days of the Roman era. Capitalism is a necessary condition for political freedom. There's no avoiding the necessity for some measure of paternalism. There are always people who need to be taken care of, and they should be taken care of. But when welfare rather than freedom becomes the dominant note, then individualism is threatened, and you're on the road to serfdom. Believe me, collectivism politically is our enemy, not our friend. Competitive capitalism is the only realistic way to go, given what history tells us, given the nature of man. And people say, well, competitive capitalism based on greed. Well, show me a government that's not based on greed. You think communism didn't run on greed? You think socialism doesn't run on greed? You think Nazism didn't run on greed? The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate self-interest. It's always been that way. It's always going to be. That's the nature of man. Economics, in one sentence, is all about how people respond to incentive and disincentive. Anything else about economics is just a footnote. That's the whole ballgame. And that's what makes the world go round so far as humanity is concerned. We're not talking there about the church, where we have so much altruism going on because you have hearts that are changed by the Lord. But you're a tiny minority of the world. The great achievements of civilization have not come from government bureaus. The only cases in recorded history that the masses have ever escaped from grinding poverty were where they had capitalism and largely free trade. The masses are worst off in the societies that depart from that. and the record of history is quite clear on this. There has been no alternative way so far discovered of improving the lot of ordinary people that can hold a candle to the productive activities that are unleashed by a free enterprise system. We're just not going to find a bunch of angels on earth to organize society for us. We're stuck with people. And given the nature of man, this is the way it is. So for us as Christians, we can have a theory of government that's like that, or you can have some other theory of government. But for us as Christians, to put this in perspective, politics is interesting like a baseball game is interesting, or like maybe a soap opera is interesting. You're interested in what's going on. You have convictions. You have things that you'd like to see happen. But that's not your main interest in life. And even if your government falls, perish the thought, but if our American government were to fall, that's not the end for us. We can function quite well under whatever government they give to us. They may shorten our lives, but that might not be all bad either. The powers that be are ordained of God, and I'm glad that we have the right to vote if we so choose. If you choose to vote, try to do the best you can, at least not to make things any worse. You know, we're told to do good to all men, especially those who are of the household of faith. Sometimes by voting, you might be able to do a little good for somebody. And I caution you in this, because political parties are mentioned in this question. I caution you in this. Think these things through. Please do not vote for a certain political party just because your parents or your grandparents did. You may end up supporting things that your parents never supported and never would have supported. So look into these things beyond the surface and beyond the words that are used. Political parties change just like the meaning of words change. Can a Democrat be saved? Yes. Can a Republican be saved? Yes. Absolutely. Does it really matter who's president? There is a scope where it matters, but as far as the Christian life is concerned, we can serve God under any situation. When Peter and John were in prison for preaching the gospel, what was the church doing? The church was praying. You got it. They didn't set a picket line in front of the Sanhedrin council with banners and posters. They didn't have their pitchforks and torches chanting outside the chambers of the Sanhedrin. They didn't campaign to raise money to publish the misfortunes of Peter and John at the hands of the Sanhedrin. They prayed. And what did they pray for? They prayed for boldness so they could keep preaching the gospel no matter what the cost might be. That was their focus. And that was the church. And we're the church. That was the response. That should be our response. I take from it that we respond in a godly way with as little disruption as possible and without causing unnecessary problems. We are leaven, and leaven works quietly and unobtrusively over time. We're so blessed to be citizens of a country where our rights are protected. And here in the Midwest in particular, we live in a part of the country, most of us, where perhaps we generally tend to have less problems than in some other parts of the country. I don't know what the future holds for us politically. I know this: America's moral decline is spiritual, not political. I know this, that the solution to society's ills is the gospel, not politics. But I don't know what the future holds. Thank God I know who holds the future. I know that there are people in this assemblage right now who would stand up in front of one of these trees and be shot to death for their faith in Jesus Christ rather than to recant the name of the Lord. And I feel very good that you are here in that frame of mind. Many of you, probably hundreds of you, are in that frame of mind at this moment. The reason that's so important is that if you don't have something worth dying for, you don't have a thing worth living for. So this is the focus of our lives: the Lord Jesus Christ, the advancement of His kingdom. We let all the rest of the chips fall where they will. "We know you'll express an opinion and truth that will satisfy all concerned," said Eric. So I hope you're all satisfied, and if you're not, I'll keep talking until you all are. Suddenly everybody just got satisfied. Thank you all very much for your kind attention. We conclude this evening by once again extending the Lord's invitation. If you're outside of Christ tonight and we can help you obey the gospel in any way, either in primary obedience or if you want to tell us about something that needs to be prayed for by the entire group, we extend you this invitation, this opportunity to come forward to the front as we stand together and sing the invitation song.